So Daniel chapter 3, and we let off last week with Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, in a little bit of a tight spot. You will recall that possibly in response to the news of chapter 2, that Nebuchadnezzar would be the greatest king of the greatest empire. He built this huge statue of himself. He placed it in this central and highly visible location. And then he called for all the various leaders to come to the dedication ceremony, and he commanded that they all worship this image that he'd set up. Well, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they don't worship idols, do they? They worship God, the one and only God. And so they refused to worship. The Chaldeans, perhaps still a little sore about the events of chapter 2, the Chaldeans come and rat on them, and Nebuchadnezzar calls them to him, and he gives them a warning, but he also gives them a second chance, and then they respond to him by saying, it really doesn't matter how many chances you give us, we're not going to bow. And if you'll remember, when the king gave the command for the second time, as well as the second opportunity, he asked them almost rhetorically, he said, "Who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" And that is verse 17, I believe. Verse 15, he says, "Who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" So the king recognized that their hesitancy, or rather refusal, to bow was not simply laziness or a lack of desire to bow, but rather their refusal to bow was in devotion to another god. And so he's essentially saying, look, king, I'm the king of Babylon, right? I'm the greatest king of the greatest empire. And what god is there out there that you serve that's more powerful than me and can save you from my wrath if you won't obey me? And if you'll recall, in verses 16, 17, and 18, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego respond to him and say, look, we're not afraid to answer you in this matter because we serve a God who can deliver us from your hand, right? They said, if you throw us in the fire, our God is able to save us out of the fire. But even if he chooses not to save us out of the fire, and even if it means death at your hand, it doesn't matter. We will not bow to you or to your image. And so that's where we left off, and so that's where we're going to pick up. So we're in Daniel chapter 3, verse 19, and we see the response of King Nebuchadnezzar to their persistent refusal. It says verse 19, the first half, "Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." So, you know, king or no king, how many of us would say, I don't like being told no? And as humans, right, we're saddened, we're disappointed, we're upset when people don't like the things that we value, when people disregard the things that we've worked hard for. And so Nebuchadnezzar is no doubt feeling a little hurt by this interaction. Oh, you don't like my idol. But it also makes him really angry. Like, hey, like, I'm the greatest king of the greatest empire. I'm the head of gold, and I set up this image for you to worship, and you won't worship my image. And that makes him really upset, furious, in fact. So much so that it says his face is changed, right? How many of us have seen the cartoon where the person gets so mad that their face turns red, and they got steam that come out both ears? You guys know what I'm talking about? That's what it's saying. He was so angry that the form of his visage changed. He was so angry, he was visibly moved by anger. And some, you know, some people, they're the kind of the silent murder type, where, you know, if looks could kill, you'd be in the grave. But others are the, you know, yell and scream and carry on and hoot and holler and threaten type. And it seems that Nebuchadnezzar is that second type. So he's really angry. It says, "Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace 1/7 times more than it was wont to be heated." And that word "wont" just means typical or usual. And the use of the phrase one seven times more, it's not necessarily literally make it, you know, however many degrees it is, multiply that by seven. But that's just a figurative expression for, you know, as much as possible or a lot. And we see that type of figurative language in Proverbs. Proverbs 24:16, Solomon says, "For a just man falleth seven times and riseth up again, but the wicked shall fall into mischief." That doesn't mean, okay, well, I fall into the same sin seven times, so now I don't have to worry about the temptation anymore. I'm now past the, you know, seven-time period, and now we're done with that temptation. No, that idea of seven times is just, it happens a lot, right? A wise man falls a lot and rises again, but the wicked shall fall into mischief. He also says in Proverbs 26, "The sluggard is wiser in his own conceit than seven men that can render a reason." So as long as you get eight men to go confront a fool, you'll prevail with him. No. What he's saying is, you know, a fool in his own wisdom, it doesn't matter how many people you send to him to reason with him, because in his own mind, he's right. And so that phrase, one seven times more, it's just a figurative expression for a lot. So Nebuchadnezzar, he's really angry, and he tells the men, "I want you to make this furnace as hot as you can make this furnace." And then in verse 20 and 21, it says, "And he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. And then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." And so Nebuchadnezzar commands that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be bound tight and thrown into the fire. And one commentator notes that, you know, Nebuchadnezzar seemingly is taking every precaution, to make sure that these guys are made an example of, so that way no one else would dare to resist him and to resist his rule. And so maybe this is purely out of anger and a desire to quell this rebellion, but perhaps another part of it is fear, right? Like he's taking every precaution, one, because he wants to quell this rebellion, right? He wants to stomp it into the ground. But there might be another part of him that's saying, "Hey, I better be willing to put my money where my mouth is. Like if I've said there's no God that can deliver you from my hand, I better make sure you die," right? And so he takes all these precautions, you know, he says, who's this God that they're choosing over me? What kind of power does he have that they would be willing to stand up for me, or stand up to me on his behalf? I better pull out all the stops, better make sure I don't lose face here, because if they survive this, even on accident, I could lose even more of my following. And so he has them bound very tightly, and the inclusion of the description about their clothing adds to the eagerness with which he wants them thrown in the fire. Like the executioners don't even get a chance to take their clothes off before they go in. And if you'll recall in the account of the crucifixion, right, what does Jesus say, you know, prophetically? What did they do? They took all his clothes off of him, and then they divided his clothes among them, right? And this was kind of a common practice that whenever someone was being executed, the executioners would get dibs on your clothes, right? And so here we don't see that though. Nebuchadnezzar's in such a rush, he's like, forget their clothes, forget who's getting their clothes, just bind them, toss them in there, get it done. And so he has them thrown in to the fire. And what's interesting is that King Solomon kind of comments a little bit, if you will, on the idea of what the king's doing here. And of course, King Solomon would have come before Babylon, so Babylon would have come after the reign of King Solomon. But King Solomon, as a very wise king, he actually has something to say about what Nebuchadnezzar is doing. He says, "The wrath of a king is as messengers of death, but a wise man will pacify it." And that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar intended to happen. He wanted death, and that's exactly what did happen, but it didn't happen exactly the way he intended it to. We read in verse 22, "Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent, and because the furnace was exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." See, the king in his haste had the fire heated so much that it killed the men that carried Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to it. And this isn't the only place that we read about folks getting a taste of their own medicine, right? In Esther, we see that Naaman is so fixated. Ellie, go sit in your seat. We see that Naaman is so fixated on revenge against Mordecai because he perceives that he's been wronged. Naaman ends up getting hung on the gallows he built for Mordecai. And later in this same book, in Daniel, we read about a group of men that try to have Daniel killed by lions because they're so angry, they feel like injustice has been committed against them, and then they themselves end up getting killed by the same lions. And so it's interesting that the king wants death, and the king gets death, but it's not what he intended. It's interesting that Solomon also has something to say about this. He says, "He that is soon angry dealeth foolishly." He says, "A man of wicked devices is hated." And another version of Scripture, instead of saying, "He that is soon angry deals foolishly," it says, "A quick-tempered man does foolish things." And that's exactly what we see here. Nebuchadnezzar is so quick-tempered, he's so angry that he's not thinking things through, and it ends up costing him some of the lives of his own men. And we kind of look at that and we're like, well, what did Nebuchadnezzar expect? But what's interesting is, you know, sometimes we get angry, and in our anger, we do something foolish, and it ends up hurting somebody else that we didn't intend to hurt. It ends up costing us something we didn't want to pay, whether it's a loss of a privilege, or a loss of a friendship, a loss of a job, or a hurtful word that you can't take back. You know, and we're all guilty of that. I had to apologize to somebody on Friday because I said something, and as soon as I said it, I was like, ugh, Benj, you should not have said that. And so we all do that, right? We get quick-tempered, and we do foolishly, and we often have to go and apologize. But in Nebuchadnezzar's case, he couldn't apologize because they were dead. In Proverbs 29:11, says, "A fool uttereth all his mind, but a wise man keepeth it until afterwards." And so Nebuchadnezzar makes this really hasty, really angry decision, and the men that take them up to throw them into the fire die before they can even throw them in. But nevertheless, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego still end up in the fire. We read in verse 23, "And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down, bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." And I don't know if I said this last time or not. I don't think so. We don't know exactly what this furnace was used for. Some say it was used for smelting metal. Others say it was probably some sort of like crematory furnace. It might have just been cold, and so they had the furnace for heat. It was obviously in a public place, and we're going to see that in a minute, that it was in a public place because lots of people were there observing this, but either way, the way this furnace was built is that there was an opening at the top, or there was a like a platform at the top with an opening where you could kind of put stuff in it, but then it would have a door at the bottom that you could open to pull stuff out, and it wouldn't have been huge. It would have been a little more on the compact size, so that way the heat could be concentrated. And so these guys likely took up a good chunk of space in the furnace, but either way, they go in from the top, and then Nebuchadnezzar would be sitting down at the bottom watching, all right? And so they fall into the furnace, and they're there. So they go in, and he's watching, and, you know, maybe he's gloating about how he's the king, and no one gets to challenge him, and, you know, who's this weak god now that, you know, that would protect these guys from going in the fire, you know? My guys died, but they still fell in, and, you know, maybe he's gloating a little bit, right? Maybe he's kind of puffing himself up that, you know, he's the boss here. But then something happens, and something changes. And we read about it in verse 24. It says that Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished. He was awestruck. He was dumbstruck. And rose up in haste and spake and said unto the counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" They answered and said unto the king, "True, O king." And you can almost, at least I can almost see the scenario kind of play out in my mind. You know, he's sitting there and he's looking at the fire and he's gloating and he's puffing himself up. And, you know, I'm the boss, I'm the king. You know, they opposed me, and now they're in the fire, and what God is there that could deliver them? He failed because they're in the fire, and he's just really puffing himself up, and then he kind of jumps up, and he goes, hey, wait a minute. Hey, guys, how many men did we throw in there? Three. Okay, and none of our guys fell in there, right? Like all our guys that died, like, they didn't fall in when they died, right? Like, none of our guys are in there? No, just those three. Are you sure? Yeah, everybody's accounted for. Like, you know, all the guys that died, you know, they're over there. None of them fell in. None of our other guys fell in. Like, it's just the three of them in there, King. Why do you ask? Like, we definitely threw three men in there, King. You know, why do you ask? He answered and said, lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. It was at this point that Nebuchadnezzar realizes, maybe I was wrong about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God. Not only was he protecting them, he's right there in the fire with them. And when he says the form of the fourth is like the Son of God, this is a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ, a Christophany. And you can imagine that he's really shocked at this. It says that Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fire furnace, although probably not too close, because he already saw what happened when you get too close. And so he comes near, but not too near, to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace, and he spake and said, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth and come hither. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth, supplied out of the midst of the fire. And so you can imagine that Nebuchadnezzar's attitude is a little different here. He's not angry anymore. He's not furious anymore. He's amazed. And perhaps he's just a little bit embarrassed too. So he comes near to the mouth of the furnace. He says, hey guys, I think you serve a God who's a little bit bigger than I am. Would you guys come out here? And you know, if I'm Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you know, my vindictive side, I kind of wish they'd have been like, well, you know, I thought you were the Most High One. Like you said here, servants of the Most High God, I thought you were the Most High God. You know, you that's what you were saying 5 minutes ago. You know, if you want us, come on in and get us. That's what I would say. But they didn't say that. But they come out. And so they come out, and it says, and the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors being gathered together saw these men, upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was a hair of their head singed, neither were their coats changed, they weren't burned, singed, nothing like that, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. And this is maybe where a little bit more of the embarrassment sets in for Nebuchadnezzar, because we see that everybody was there watching. Like, all the princes, governors, captains, counselors that he had called to worship, all these people that had bowed down in service to him, they're all watching, all right? So this execution, it's not a private execution. It's a very public execution. Like, everybody's there. Everybody's watching it. Nebuchadnezzar thinks that he's going to very publicly quell this rebellion. And instead, he just proved to everybody that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God is the Most High God. The king, let's see, I lost my place here. The king said, you know, who's this God that can deliver you from my hand? And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say, this God who's right here with us. He's the Most High God. And so what's interesting is that all the steps that Nebuchadnezzar took to ensure their demise really just adds to the power of the one who delivered them. You know, he threw them in, but they didn't burn. He had them bound, but they walked out. He didn't give the men to take their clothes off, yet their clothes were unsinged and smoke-free, right? And so, like, everything that he's, like, looking to just kind of put the beat down on them, the Lord uses every single one of those things to show that he's in control. you know, you might throw me in here, but you can't make me burn. You can bind me, but I'm going to walk out of here. You know, you can leave all my clothes on, but my clothes will testify to the power of my God. How many of us have ever done s'mores or hot dogs over a fire? Some of us did it together about 2 weeks ago. You come home or you go in the church or, you know, you're done, right? And you go to change your clothes, and what do your clothes smell like? Smell like a campfire, right? How many of you guys like that smell? I love that smell while I'm doing the campfire. But as soon as the campfire's done, I'm done. And so I would not wear a cologne called Smoke from a Campfire, but while I'm there, I love it. And so they come out of the fire, but there is no smell of fire on them, right? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they come out of the fire, they're completely unharmed, and there's no evidence that they had ever even been near a fire, let alone in the fire. And so Nebuchadnezzar's response to this then in verse 28, it says, "Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word, and yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God." And so Nebuchadnezzar blesses God, and he recognizes his power to deliver Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and then he commands them for their faith and trust in him, even in the face of death. They refused to listen to the word of the king, right? They were willing to yield their bodies even to death in order that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. And so he then makes a decree. He says, "Therefore, I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort." And so he makes a decree that anyone that says anything negative against God would be destroyed completely. And the reason for that is that he recognizes that there is no God that has power like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's God. And what's sad here is that even though Nebuchadnezzar has now twice seen the power of God demonstrated, his relationship with God is still distant. Well, Pastor Benj, how do you know that? In chapter 2, he talks about the God of Daniel. In chapter 3, he talks about the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He has not yet taken him to be his God. But thankfully, we know the whole story, and we know that part's coming, so come back next week, and you'll see when it becomes the God of Nebuchadnezzar. But for now, his relationship with God is still distant, despite the fact that he's now twice seen God's power on display. And then verse 30, it says, "Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon." And so like Daniel in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar promotes Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego within the kingdom, and now all four of these men are very prominent figures in the province. They're very close to the king, and their influence over him is going to be seen more in chapter 4 as Nebuchadnezzar's story progresses. And I had said at the very beginning of this book that Nebuchadnezzar's original intention in bringing the first round of Jewish exiles was to indoctrinate them to Babylonian society as a way to kind of help expand his kingdom and his ideals. Like, if I can win over like the best and the brightest of your people, then when the rest of you get here, I have you as an ally to reach your own people. And that's actually a pretty good missionary strategy too, by the way, and we can draw that parallel another time. You know, if I can teach someone to win their own people, that is far more effective than if I try to win their people. And so what Nebuchadnezzar is doing is actually a really good missionary strategy. Maybe someone should write a book, A Strategy of Missions According to Nebuchadnezzar. But nevertheless, his whole plan was to indoctrinate these Jewish exiles, But now we see that because of their faith and because of their trust in God, we now have four of these men who are very close to the king, and they're influencing him. They're reforming Babylon from the inside. And so, in one way, you could say his plan has backfired in the best possible way. And it's only going to get better in chapter 4. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego learned firsthand the truth of Solomon in Proverbs 29, and we need to learn it too, when he says, "The fear of man bringeth a snare, but whoso putteth his trust in the Lord shall be safe." Doesn't mean life's always going to be easy. Doesn't mean you're not going to have trials and temptations and hardships. Like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they had to go in the fire. Like they had to go in the fire. But he says, "Whoso puts their trust in the Lord shall be safe." And God will always take care of us, and God will never allow something to happen to us that is outside of his plan that he can't redeem to use as a testimony for him. And so I have just a couple of points here, and then we'll progress. Like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we need to realize three things. One, God uses our faithfulness to testify of his character. The refusal of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to bow said something about the God they were standing up for, and Nebuchadnezzar ultimately recognized it. At first, he scoffed at it, but in the end, he realized that the God they serve is a good God who is worth standing for. And in the same way, our testimony for the Lord says something about our God. Our faithfulness to God, our willingness to obey him, we talked about that this morning, our willingness to obey him, our willingness to go through hard things for him, our willingness to give up the pleasures that this world has to offer, we looked at that in chapter 1, those things say something about the character of God. My God is better than that thing, whatever it is, or that person, whoever that person is. My God is worth more. He's worth going through trials for. He's worth giving up sin for. You know, if they had bowed to the pressure, then Nebuchadnezzar and all the people would have missed out on seeing how good God is in that situation. And so we need to realize that God uses our faithfulness to testify of his character. Two, we need to realize that God uses our trials to testify of his power. Now, this one's pretty obvious. You know, God delivered them from the fire, and that's something that Nebuchadnezzar recognized not everybody can do. Like, if anybody could survive a fire, that doesn't really show anything. And oftentimes we find ourselves in trials, and what makes them so difficult is that so often we are completely powerless in them. There's nothing that we could do, and there's nothing that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego could do to change the outcome of this account, but God could, and God did. And in our lives, God uses our trials to show us just how powerful he is and to show others around us how powerful he is. If they had bowed to the pressure, Nebuchadnezzar would not have gotten to see the power of God over that fire. That 2 Corinthians 12, verses 9 and 10, which is quite possibly my favorite verse or two verses in the Bible, says, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." Paul says, "Most gladly, therefore, I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me." He says, "I take pleasure in distresses and persecutions and hardships and wants and all that stuff." He says, "Because when I am weak, then am I strong." Right? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were the strongest they'd ever been when they were in that fire because they were wholly leaning on God. And so our ability to persevere in trials is a testimony to the power of God. We can witness to others in the way that we handle hardship. You know, this past year, we've had three funerals. And so we have three new widows this year. Two of you are in this room. Three new widows this year. And I can't tell you how many people that came to your funerals, your husband's funerals, Linda's not here right now, who said, "I don't know how she's holding up right now." I do. I can tell you exactly how she's holding up right now. It's the power of God in her life. And how we handle, see, the world can't handle hardship. Like, the suicide rate in America, or in the world, is like, it's rising every year. Because the lost world, they can't handle pressure. They can't handle hardship. They don't have the strength to deal with that. And we don't either. But we have God. And so when we, with God's help, go through a trial, that testifies of God's power. Because it's not me, it's all Him. And that leads us to the third point. We need to realize that God uses the fire to show us His presence. You know, you ever hear the poem, The Footprints in the Sand? You guys know that one? And I can't quote it, but it's like, I was walking down the beach with Jesus and, walking through the halls of my life. And I get to the end and I said, Lord, all the hardest parts of my life, there was only one set of footprints. Why did you leave me at all the hardest parts of my life? And Jesus says, no, my child, those are the times I carried you. So it wasn't my footprints who were missing. It was your footprints who were missing. You know, and there's a song that we sing, Lord, I Need You. And the songwriter recognizes that when life is easy, sometimes we can be tempted to think that we don't need God. But when life is hard and we can't deal on our own, that's when we realize how much we need God. And that's when God's presence really comes shining through for us in a meaningful way. God uses trials to show us just how involved He is in our lives. And so the conclusion of all of this, and it's a hard conclusion to come to, but the conclusion of all of this is that sometimes the fire is best. It's best for me. It's best for others. It's best for my testimony. It's not easy, but it's best. And when God says that He works all things together for good to them that love Him and to them who are the called according to His purpose, sometimes that includes me going in the fire. And I don't like it, but if I understand what God is trying to do through my life and through my trials, then I can surrender to the fire, I can step back, and I can let Him step forward and show me His power, show me His presence. Whoops, I just went away from my slides. Show me His power, show me His presence, and show me His goodness, right? Show me His character. I was trying to go back to that slide. And so sometimes the fire is best. We looked at this a good bit in James chapter 1, and it's interesting that I actually have James chapter 1 here, and these are my notes from when I preached this several years ago. We've been looking at James a lot, and we spent 8 weeks in James chapter 1, but James says to count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. Why? How? He answers that in verse 2. He says, the way that you find joy in trials is knowing that it's for a reason, that God is going to do something through it, right? Trials exist because we're fallen people, right? There's that right theology of trials, right? Why did Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's trial exist? Because Nebuchadnezzar was fallen, right? And so trials exist because we're fallen people. And so God is never the source of our suffering, but He does allow it so that He can use it to do something in our lives, just like we see Him doing here. I want to leave you with one more passage, and then we're going to watch something, and then we're going to go to our discussion. But Peter also addresses this issue or this idea. He says, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. He says, but rather rejoice, insomuch as ye are partakers of Christ's suffering, that when His glory shall be revealed, ye may be glad also with exceeding joy. He says, if ye be reproached for the name of Christ, happy are ye, for the Spirit of glory and of God resteth upon you. On their part, He's evil spoken of, right? And on Nebuchadnezzar's part, God was evil spoken of, but on your part, He's glorified. Right? Nebuchadnezzar had spoken evil of God, and then God glorified Himself through Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, And God can and wants to do the same thing through us. And so let us do that.